Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan sat down to Thanksgiving dinners today, but other than that, in Iraq at least, it was just another day of violence. A suicide car bomb detonated outside a hospital in the center of a town south of Baghdad, killing at least 30 people, wounding at least 36, including 2 U.S. soldiers. According to the Iraqi military, the bomber targeted U.S. vehicles parked near the hospital, where U.S. troops were distributing toys to Iraqi children. The U.S. military also announced today that 4 U.S. troops were killed in Baghdad on Wednesday. Scott Peterson is with the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us from Baghdad. Scott, can you give us a sense of the current level of insurgent violence in Iraq? Has it risen in the last week?
I think it's been rising in the last couple of weeks, actually. It was fairly quiet 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago or so. I think the insurgents were basically catching their breath, if you will, in preparation for the December 15 election. I think what we're seeing now is the beginning of the surge of violence that is going to accompany this election. I think it's inevitable. We've seen that during the last 2 elections earlier this year, and I think that this one won't be any different. I think this is one that really does matter, that will be a permanent 4-year government that will emerge from this vote. And also, I think that for them, it creates even further difficulties, because the Sunni minority, which has in the past been one of the driving forces behind the insurgency, has actually embraced the election in terms of calling on their people to come out and vote for it.
Well, a Sunni leader and 3 of his sons were killed yesterday. It said as part of that attempt to keep Sunnis from participating in these upcoming elections. But you're saying that attacks like that aren't working? Do you think the Sunnis are embracing the election?
Well, I mean, the Sunnis realize very, very much that they made a mistake last January by boycotting the election. And in that case, they had very, very little say in helping to write the constitution, in the makeup of the interim government, it was created 1 year ago. And so we began to see, just in October, just before the referendum vote, we began to see people, Sunni leaders and others, even issuing fatwas saying that Sunnis should go out and vote, that it was important that their voice be heard. And so they voted in growing numbers, if you will, in October. But certainly Sunnis that I have spoken to, in Fallujah especially, and I know that this is a broader issue for the Sunni body politic, they are planning on voting so they can maximize their voice in this new permanent government. And as much as they are not in favor of the government, they recognize that they really are shut out if they don't at least participate.
Well, Scott, we wanted to ask you, the insurgent attackers who killed that Sunni leader were wearing Iraqi army uniforms. And Iraqi was quoted as saying that you can buy those uniforms in any store. Now, we also hear this week that the Pentagon is considering modest troop reductions in Iraq as soon as this summer, with U.S. troops replaced by Iraqi troops. But when you read things like, you know, you can buy an Iraqi uniform in any store, it doesn't seem to speak to the readiness of the Iraqi army.
Well, this is true, but it's also true that there have been some kind of death squads, if you will, or other agents that are more connected with the government who have been acting on the part of the government against opponents. And of course, many Sunni leaders are in that sense considered opponents. So it's kind of just a different side of the sectarian war coin, if you will.
Scott Peterson of the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad. Scott, I just want to ask you about one last piece of news that's just come across. So this may catch you, and we just want your first thoughts on it. Apparently, Jordan's king is asking his new premier for an all-out war against militant Islam. Now, we know the recent attacks in Jordan emanated from Iraq. I'm just wondering, do you think that this means that Jordan might be pulled into conflict with Iraq, given that the militants are there?
Well, I mean, all-out war is what many people feel that they're fighting here. And, and you see more and more Iraqis getting pulled into it when they become victimized.
I'm wondering if we'll see Jordan's troops crossing over into Iraq, but of course we can't know.
Well, I wouldn't expect that to happen at all. In fact, what we will see, I'm sure, are much more stringent border controls between Iraq and Jordan, and probably much more surveilling of that actual desert border, because it's not just the road that crosses up there in the middle of the desert, but you've also got huge areas where people can cross virtually unnoticed.
Scott Peterson, reporting from Iraq for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Baghdad. Scott, thanks so much, and a happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you, and to you as well.
Well, of course, millions of Americans are celebrating the Thanksgiving holiday here in the States, but some Indians or Native Americans view this holiday much differently, as they have since 1970. Many are protesting Thanksgiving by holding what they call the National Day of Mourning on a hill above Plymouth Rock in Massachusetts. Tradition associates Thanksgiving with a meal held in the autumn of 1621, cooked up by the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag Indians in Plymouth, Mass., but the feast celebrated the harvest the pilgrims had reaped with the help of the Indians after the new settlers spent the first winter in what we now call New England. A new book challenges conventional wisdom about the Indians and the pilgrims. In fact, the book challenges what we learned in school about the world Columbus set foot on in 1492. The book is called 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. The author is Charles Mann, correspondent for The Atlantic and Science magazine. Our interview with Charles Mann first aired on Columbus Day, and the conversation started with the debate over the word Indian.
Indian, I mean, we have to say, is a kind of a stupid name, because obviously the people we're talking about as Indians don't come from India, so right. It's a historical mistake.
Right, because Columbus thought that he had landed in Asia and India.
Right. Yeah. Now, in the 1960s, there was a proposal to replace that with Native Americans, and there's a couple problems with that. In its own way, that's just as problematic, because literally speaking, anybody who's born in this country is a Native American. I'm a Native American, perhaps you're a Native mm-hmm. American. The other thing it does is erase the distinction between Indians, the people that lived here and in South America, and the peoples of the extreme far north, the Inuit and the Eskimo, who are a different group of people who came over later. And that kind of eliminates that distinction. And the third thing, as I learned when I was researching this book, is that Indians themselves don't call themselves Native Americans, at least none of the ones that I spoke to. And in Central and South America, the people there, the indigenous people there, when I would refer to them as Native Americans, they laughed at me and said, oh, no, those are just people north of the Rio Grande. We're Indians here. So with their ridicule ringing in my ears, I decided to use Indians in my book.
Right. And why did you decide to write the book?
Well, this has been an interest of mine for a long time, and it really started, I guess, in the early 1980s when I kind of by accident ended up in Yucatan and saw the Maya ruins and thought, wow, these are magnificent. Why didn't I know anything about them? And from time to time, I would try to arrange journalist reporting trips that would take me there, and I would get a chance to see some more. And I talked to various researchers along the way, and gradually I realized that the picture they had of what the Americas were like before Columbus was tremendously different from the picture that I had been taught in school. And then in the 1990s, my son started going to high school, and what he was taught was the same as what I had been taught, stuff that by now I knew was at least a generation out of date. And I thought, somebody ought to write a book.
Well, let's talk about some of that conventional wisdom that I learned as well in school. Remind us of what that is, the conventional wisdom about the Americas pre-Columbus.
Well, the basic thing that at least I was taught was that Indians walked across the Bering Straits about 12,000 years ago, that they lived for the most part in small scattered bands, except for maybe a couple places like Mexico City and Peru, and that they had so little impact on the environment that when Columbus landed, the Americas were, for all intents and purposes, a wilderness. And I guess one way to sum up the prevailing thinking now among researchers is to say that all three of these are now thought to be wrong.
Right. Tell us, what is the new thinking?
Indians were here for far longer than previously believed. They're here in much greater numbers, and far from being a wilderness, the Americas thoroughly bore the human mark, the human fingerprints all over of its original inhabitants.
As you write, they had thoroughly imposed their will on the landscape.
Yes.
And you describe some of these places, and if anyone has been lucky enough to see some of them, I've seen Tikal in Guatemala or Machu Picchu. Describe some of these footprints.
Well, I guess if you had been able to fly in a plane in, 1491, just before Columbus arrived, and you were flying from north to south, say starting from here in Boston, you would have flown along the coast of North America, and you would have seen almost the entire coast lined with farms and farming villages, some of them quite large, with the fields extending many miles inland. You would have seen wide open forests that had been kept open by burning, annual burning. If you flew during the fall, which was the burning season, you would see mile-long lines of flame. Then if you went to central Mexico, you would see in central Mexico, it was then probably the world's most densely populated place. Millions upon millions of people in very large cities. The city of Tenochtitlan, which is the capital of the Aztec Empire, was then population of on the order of 250,000 or so, which is larger than London or Paris. Mm-hmm. And similarly, you go into South America, you'd see the Inca Empire, many millions of people there, and an extraordinary expanse that stretched the equivalent from Stockholm to Cairo, with the world's largest highway network. And then even in the Amazon, where the whole ecosystem of the tropical forest was regulated and controlled to a large extent by human beings.
One thing we haven't mentioned that you found, I mean, yes, the Indians are now thought to have been here longer, in larger numbers, bigger populations, many in cities, as you said. They had thoroughly imposed their will on the landscape. But there's one other element. They had no immunity.
A quirk of history, the exact cause of which scientists are still arguing about, most of the large mammals in North and South America died about, on the order of 13,000, 14,000 years ago. And as a result, Native Americans, Indians, had almost no domesticated animals. And the reason that this played a role, in addition to obviously having an enormous impact on their societies, was that most of the terrible diseases of humankind come when humans and animals live in very close proximity over a long period of time, and animal diseases mutate, and scientists call it jump the species barrier. And thus, measles was originally a cow disease, bovine rinderpest, smallpox was either from horsepox or camelpox, depending which geneticist you talk to. Flu comes from birds. The list goes on and on. With no domesticated animals, Indians didn't have any of these, what they're called crowd diseases.
Yeah, was it Cortez that traveled with his pigs?
Yeah, no, it was just running DeSoto. Around the most of the Spaniards traveled with pigs as kind of ambulatory meat lockers. What happened, though, is these diseases, they brought them inadvertently, so they hit this completely unprepared hemisphere. And people not only did not have natural immunity to them, but because they had so few epidemics of any sort in general, they didn't know anything about quarantine, and so somebody would get sick, friends and family would come around them to comfort them, they would get infected, the whole village or town would get infected, and people would just run off, and in this way, the epidemic would radiate out like a string of firecrackers into the countryside, spreading far beyond the original place where Europeans landed. And so Europeans were constantly coming into places that had recently been emptied by these terrible diseases, well ahead of seeing any Europeans.
That's Charles Mann. He's author of 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. Well, after the break, what the Indians, before they were wiped out, thought of the Europeans. And here's a hint, not many Europeans took baths back then. Also later in the program, U.S. Marines celebrate Thanksgiving, one's home, one still in Iraq. Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. Young, it's here and now, and still ahead, a U.S. Marine here in our studios while his friend and fellow Marine celebrates Thanksgiving in Iraq. But first, on this Thanksgiving Day, we're rebroadcasting an interview with author Charles Mann, his book, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. Before the break, we heard about how disease wiped out what was really a sophisticated Indian civilization before the Europeans arrived with their viruses. And because there is a missing record of this culture, Charles says the vacuum was filled by people's imaginations and their hopes for what Indians were like. Well, one of the people who bought into those misconceptions was Henry David Thoreau.
Henry David Thoreau, extolled the wilderness as he saw it, and, saw it as being lost by the Europeans coming in, and sullying this wonderful place that had been maintained by Indians. And in fact, it was almost exactly the opposite in the sort of most brutal and ironic way you can imagine. The Indians thoroughly maintained that wilderness. They burned the undergrowth. It was wide open. And the reason that they did that was to encourage game, which they hunted. When they died from these epidemics sweeping through New England, which began just before the Pilgrims with an epidemic probably of viral hepatitis that killed about 90% of the population of coastal New England, all this burning ceased. The landscape suddenly became overgrown and, quote, wild. And what happened was Europeans, instead of destroying wilderness, actually created it. And if he'd wanted this kind of Indian wisdom, he would have gone out and started burning immediately.
Well, but as you know, this has been one of the criticisms of your thinking and the thinking of others that you quote, that it really kind of messes with the heads of some environmentalists because, they even had Indians on billboards. The move of some parts of the environmental movement is to get back to the pristine landscape the way the Indians lived.
The problem with it, I think, is by and large, these people were impressive landscape managers who created landscapes that they wanted to live in. These are people who, shaped the places they wanted to live in for the future. And that's an orientation, I think, that the environmental movement could, take some cues from. Rather than trying to take us back to a past that didn't exist and that we can never possibly get to, let's think about what kind of place we want to live in and see if we can build it.
Your view would make more sense because, again, as you point out, Indians, in your take, would be a thriving, changing people, which would make sense. What people would remain static over thousands of years?
Right. And there's a thing I call Holmberg's mistake after an unfortunate researcher I pick on kind of unfairly, Alan Holmberg, actually a wonderful anthropologist from Cornell. And he studied an area in Bolivia that I start off talking about. And he believed that the people who inhabited it were remnants of the Stone Age, people who had lived lives that had essentially unchanged since the Pleistocene era. And in fact, we now know that they had a rich, complicated history in that the people that he saw were as, very, very, quote, primitive, very, very simple lives, were people who had once been, much more sophisticated materially and had been terribly abused by people in Bolivia and in other parts of South America and were essentially a kind of refugee group.
Right, that he stumbled upon. And as you write, it would be like seeing someone stumbling out of a concentration camp and thinking that they depicted what the population was really like.
And had always been that way.
And yet this is a characterization that went into history. It formed some people's thoughts. I want to go to that sense that some people have of Native peoples, that they were dirty, savages. You have a beautiful passage where you describe what the Indians actually thought of the Europeans.
Well, this I'm describing is in the book is the way that the Indians of the Northeast, people speaking Algonquian and Iroquoian for the most part, regarded Europeans. And this would be recorded in European chronicles as they would talk, the Jesuits and so forth, as they would talk to the Indians. The Indians would let them know what they thought, and then the mm-hmm. Jesuits, in astonishment, would record the negative opinions that these Indians frequently held. Europeans, Indians told other Indians, were physically weak, sexually untrustworthy, atrociously ugly, and just plain smelly. The British and French, many of whom had not taken a bath in their entire lives, were amazed by the Indian interest in personal cleanliness. A Jesuit reported that the, quote, savages were disgusted by handkerchiefs, quote, they say, we place what is unclean in a fine white piece of linen and put it away in our pockets as something very precious, while they throw it upon the ground.
The Puritans, as you write about them, who confronted the Indians that were here in the New England area, come off at best as buffoons.
Well, I have to say this was a bit of a shock for me, as I'm one of those people who can actually trace back his ancestry. And, my own ancestors, the Billingtons, one of the kids almost blew up the Mayflower and the other one promptly ran away. And they were kind of Their father was the first person, the second person hanged in New England, I think. So they didn't exactly have a sterling record. But what was extraordinary was that the Pilgrims landed in New England with no food, very little supplies at the beginning of winter, and really no clue as to how they're going to make their way. It's kind of amazing, given that only half of them died.
And without the indigenous Indians, who were ultimately wiped out in large part by the diseases that the Puritans brought, they would not have survived at all.
Right. The way they did it is, for the first few months, they subsisted in large part on the corn that they dug out of Indian graves and household stashes.
Charles Mann, there are so many stories within your story, But I want to ask you one thing before we let you go. What do you think is going to happen with all this new thinking? I'm reading of some of the things that textbooks said about Indians as recently as 1987. Here's a standard high school textbook, American History, a Survey. It summed up Indian history thusly. For thousands of centuries, centuries in which human races were evolving, forming communities, and building the beginnings of national civilizations in Africa, Asia, and Europe, the continents we know as the Americas stood empty of mankind and its work. The story of Europeans in the New World, the book informs students, is the story of the creation of a civilization where none existed.
I don't think that you need to be, you know, a liberal apologist to think that it's a little strange that the history books are saying that human beings are evolving and changing everywhere on the planet except the Americas.
For thousands of years, they just sort of
stood there.
Berries, right?
I mean, it just isn't what people do. You know, we're a busy species. We're constantly doing stuff. And I have to say, as I've been, you know, traveling around the country, a lot of historians and history teachers have come up to me and have said, this is great. I didn't know this. This is wonderful. I'm going to have my students read this. So possibly this book is giving a little nudge to changing things.
The book is 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. The author is Charles Mann. We first spoke with him on Columbus Day, October 10th. Well, still ahead, a Harvard grad who joined the Marines because he wanted the very best. What does he think about calls for withdrawal from Iraq? Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. And today, about 160,000 U.S. troops are celebrating their Thanksgiving in Iraq. As we heard at the top of the program, most had turkey with the trimmings, but at least two were injured when a car bomb exploded while they delivered toys to children at a hospital. As many as 30 Iraqi citizens were killed, a sobering reminder that war does not take a holiday. Marine Corps First Lieutenant Seth Moulton just came back from Iraq last month. He's been in the Corps for nearly 4 years, and he spent about half that time serving in Iraq. Last year, Seth was in Iraq for Thanksgiving, but today he'll be with his family in Marblehead, Massachusetts. So we're very thankful that you've taken some time away from them to join us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks very much, Robin.
And I bet they are thankful that you are home.
They are very thankful, absolutely.
Yeah, I want to give some context here, Seth. You're a Harvard grad, commencement speaker, degree in physics. Your neighborhood, which, as we chat, turns out we have a lot of mutual friends from your block. It's a comfortable block. It's not the kind of block where young people join the military for financial reasons, I'm guessing. And you said you joined the Marines because you wanted to do some kind of service and you wanted to join the very best. So what are people in your neighborhood asking you about Iraq?
Well, I came home from Iraq about a month ago, and I think that a lot of Americans feel like they just really don't know exactly what's going on there. And so there's a lot of legitimate concern, definitely some rising frustration, I think. But most of all, they just want to know the truth, and they want my opinion of how things are going over there and in which course I think we should take.
Yeah, and we're going to find out more about what you think about policy. But in general, you treated well?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Very, very well. Very, very well. I mean, even if a town like Marblehead is not maybe known for producing a lot of Marines or soldiers, I've found tremendous support from the town every time I come back, and I really do appreciate that.
Well, and we know they've buried at least one recently, so we know
that's
that.
That's right.
Well, we've been watching you chat on your cell phone all day with friends in Iraq, including your friend First Lieutenant Barrett Bradstreet. He's also from Boston, but the line is kind of shaky, so what we decided to do was tape Barrett earlier. Now, you both went to Harvard together. He actually took over your position in Iraq, is that correct, when you left?
That's right. We worked together for about 2 months and did a very good handover, but now he's doing my job, and he's still there today.
Well, and I started by asking him, you know, where he was and how he was spending Thanksgiving.
Well, I'm in a place called Babel Province, and soldiers where I am now have done a good job of making a nice Thanksgiving dinner with some fried turkeys, even.
Fried turkeys. Well, and what are you doing there? What's your day like there?
Well, day-to-day, what I'm doing is working as a liaison with Iraqi commanders. But today, we're mostly with Americans just here on the coalition FOB, doing some administrative work and managing to get a pretty good meal in.
What's that like working with Iraqi commanders? Have you forged friendships? Is there a respect or a bond forming between the two, or is that not happening yet?
Well, for sure, in the work that I'm doing and that Seth was doing until recently, there absolutely is a very close bond. There are quite a few commanders who are doing, doing tremendous good work.
Is that? Do we hear a little Thanksgiving celebration going on behind you there?
Well, I'm in a room full of people, so indeed, yeah, you'll have a lot of high spirits where we are.
Have you spoken to your family back in the States?
Well, if you can believe it, I did. I managed to make a phone call just a little while ago on the same phone. So, yep, they're in Boston having a great Thanksgiving as we speak, I think.
I'm wondering, do you find yourself thinking about what Americans back here are doing on this day?
I think I do, particularly on a day like today. I suppose it's hard not to think back and think about what's happening there. And it's a lot of fond memories for sure.
Yeah. So, Lieutenant Bradstreet, what are you thankful for on this day?
Well, Robin, I'm thankful for to have so many other U.S. Marines and soldiers around me who are really working hard every day. So I'm thankful for what they're doing.
Is there anyone you want to say hello to in this area?
Well, I'd love to say hello to my parents and family, Carolyn Byrne Bradstreet and Josh, and to Kenley. And to you and your crew, thanks for the good work. I've been able to listen to your show even over here.
Oh.
So it's a great update on what's happening in Boston. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, and have a great day.
Okay, thanks, Robin.
Okay.
Give my best to Seth as well.
Well, I will. He's sitting right here, Lieutenant Barrett Bradstreet, listening on podcast in Iraq. Seth, though, as you well know, there's a debate raging here in the States about withdrawal from Iraq. And President Bush has said that a call from Democratic Congressman John Mirth for early withdrawal, coupled with questions about intelligence leading up to the war, is demoralizing troops there. You've talked to them, is it?
Well, I certainly can't speak for everyone in Iraq today, but personally I feel that those questions are important to ask. I mean, the most important thing for us to figure out right now is what is the best course ahead. And if we're asking questions like that, then I think we're legitimately trying to find an answer to that. I know I really do believe that Congressman Murther is asking those questions with the concerns of the troops in mind.
What do you think about the idea? And the Pentagon is now saying 20,000 to 30,000 troops may go home in the spring, more in the summer. What do you think about pulling troops out?
Well, I think that we certainly need to get to that point at some time in the near future. We are working very hard to get the Iraqi forces ready, but I think sometimes Americans have an unrealistic timeline in mind about how quickly that can happen.
You say, in fact, there may be a need for more troops before less troops.
Well, most areas in Iraq that I visited or worked in, the problem definitely was not having too many American troops around.
Mm.
And so I think it's difficult to see success with withdrawing troops very soon.
Yeah, especially, as you said, you were helping train Iraqi troops, and your former boss says that of the 120 Iraqi Army battalions, about 40 are at level 2. It doesn't seem like quite enough yet.
I wouldn't say so. I mean, there are an awful lot of battalions that are really contributing to the effort. And so if you have an Iraqi battalion that can contribute a company to a coalition raid, well, then maybe there are a few American platoons that don't have to go. So they're definitely helping, even if they're not self-sufficient yet. But whether they're really ready to take over yet, I think is not clear.
Well, Seth Moulton, Marine, it's a day of reflection today. Do you think that the average American really has, I mean, they may support the troops, you say you're welcomed at home, but is there more Americans could be asked to do to support the troops?
I personally think maybe. I think it's tougher. I mean, the average American really doesn't know exactly how to support the troops. I mean, I saw some of my friends from Marblehead last night out in the town, and they're very thankful and they're very respectful, but I'm not sure that they feel like there's a very tangible way that they can contribute on a daily basis
to our
effort over there. I don't have any easy answers, I guess. I mean, we really haven't been asked to do too much as a nation in terms of sacrifice. So maybe there isn't an easy answer, but they can certainly at least keep in mind the fact that there are some pretty heavy burdens in places like Iraq and Afghanistan being bore, on the shoulders of some very, 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 very young and very great Americans.
Yeah. Well, Marine Corps First Lieutenant Seth Moulton, one of them, thanks for coming to us on a day when I'm sure your family wants every second from you because you're still serving here at home. And while in Marblehead, have fun at Maddie's Sail Loft.
Thanks very much, Robin.
And thanks for coming in. What a year. Of course, war, but also the tsunami, then hurricanes Katrina, Rita, and Wilma, and then the earthquake in Pakistan. With all of these natural disasters, Americans are being asked to open their pocketbooks wider than ever before. And while the Red Cross and other organizations helping people on the Gulf Coast have been flooded with donations, some charities in other parts of the country are seeing early signs of donor fatigue. Augie Fernandez is the president of the Detroit-based Gleaners Community Food Bank. Augie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And I want to ask, do you see new people coming in for help? Are you seeing that?
Oh, we certainly are. We have approximately 400 partners in our mission of nurturing our communities by feeding our hungry neighbors. And they're seeing increases between 18 and 30%. Hmm. It's hard to believe, but in Michigan this year, there will be about a million of our neighbors looking for food assistance.
Well, and your community wasn't affected by the hurricanes, but of course you've been hit by an economic storm.
Oh, absolutely. We, you know, ever since 9/11, we have just been beaten down by the economic downturn here, and I'm sure that all of your listeners have read about Delphi and now General Motors and so on. So it just continues.
Yeah, announcing both those car companies announcing huge layoffs. Well, now on the other side of the equation, what are your contributions like?
When the hurricanes hit, and we saw a real loss of food donations coming into the food bank. Matter of fact, we were about 2 million pounds shy of the inventories that we're comfortable at coming into winter here in Michigan. We're now starting to see that turn back, and we're starting to see, if you will, a resurgence of local giving. Our first appeal for financial assistance is out, and we're waiting to see how that comes in to help us run our mission.
Why do you think that it might be back up again? Do you think it's some of the news headlines about the car company layoffs?
Well, I think it's that, and the one thing that I learned quickly about Southeast Michigan especially is that they're just always here to give and to help their neighbors. So we're starting to see that, and I believe that with all the press about the economic downturn and the new news about job loss and all, that people want to help their neighbors out here.
Oh, but wait, there's more, because, of course, we've got the increasing fuel prices, food stamp cuts coming, at least. And I'm just wondering, again, with that in mind, are you seeing people, yes, the auto industry has been volatile, and you might be seeing car workers, but are you seeing other people coming in just because of things like heating prices? Or is that just something that the media says, you know, that it's going to cut into people's pocketbooks?
Well, no, it definitely will cut into those people that we are helping, and it really cuts into those folks who are the working poor and our senior citizen population out here. Folks who are on the fixed income trying to make ends meet at the end of every week and the end of every month, and with increased fuel costs, and we're predicting over 30% increases here on natural gases and so forth. It's really going to tax their ability to make their decisions on their health care or on their food.
Yeah. So, Augie Fernandez, you said contributions are beginning to increase, but are still not keeping pace with the growing numbers of people who need food. So how do you convince people who may have already sent checks to the victims of the hurricanes that they need to give again?
You know, your listeners should know it was right for us to divert and send as much food and resources as we could to help our neighbors during that time. But it really is time now to focus back on your local pantry, your local food bank. And, you know, especially in Michigan, of course, we feel the economic woes, I think, much more than some parts. Of course, our neighbors in Ohio are feeling the same thing we are with the news from the automotive industry.
Right. And to those people, those Americans who say, but I did give to the Gulf and I give once.
I guess there's that old adage, you know, give until it feels good. And I just know that we're a nation of givers, and we're not going to let our neighbors down this season, I'm sure.
Augie Fernandez, president of the Detroit-based Gleaners Community Food Bank. Augie, good luck to you, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
You also.
Well, stay with us. A trip to Vermont to see the snow geese, that's coming up here and now. here and now, and this Thanksgiving, we have an old chestnut for you. Some listeners might remember a pilgrimage we made to Vermont to see the annual migration of the snow geese with my uncle Lachlan McLaughlin Field, who, like the geese, was slowly leaving us. He was 88 and had just begun a bout with Alzheimer's. Well, Uncle Locke passed away just before Thanksgiving last year at the age of 91. So here again, the story of the trip I am so thankful I took. The snow geese, thousands of them, touched down every fall at a refuge called Dead Creek. My Uncle Locke had taken me there once to see the brown Canadian geese, but I wanted to see the snows. My cousin Peggy kept writing this fall, telling me that the snows had arrived. Finally, I got the subtext of her postcard. The leaves were falling. The snow geese would soon be leaving. And at 88, it's not like my uncle was going to wait around forever either. So up to Vermont we went. Uncle Locke?
Yo!
Hi!
Hey, yo!
We should go see the geese while we can.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go with you.
My uncle, Lachlan McLaughlin Field, looms large in my branch of the family. We were from the suburbs of New York. He collected arrowheads and with his son carved duck decoys. He and my late Aunt Martha spent years in the war, then came to Middlebury where he taught high school art. To us, he was General Patton meets Norman Rockwell.
I can't drive the car anymore. I haven't been out of this. I haven't seen it. You're the first person I've seen in this house in 2 weeks.
No.
That's true.
Well, hardly. It's just that at 88, Uncle Locke recently had to give up cross-country skiing. He's not painting as much.
Sit around. Vegetate.
Not today. We're going to geese.
Pro. What, in case someone steals it?
When was the last time you heard an alarm up here?
I got it.
So, off to Dead Creek, about a 20-minute drive from Middlebury. And on the way, we would do what relatives do this time of year, whether convening to go see a bird or to eat one. We just talked.
So, have you been following all the news? You know, all the fighting in Afghanistan and...
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you something. At my age, all I can remember is fighting. It's been going on for years. Slow down, because you're going to go across the traffic that goes that way. You go straight.
Didn't you fight in the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, yeah, me and several hundreds of thousands of other people.
Yeah, I didn't think you were there by yourself.
Yeah, all over, I held them up. Yeah, that was sort of cold weather. A lot of snow.
Tell me about Dead Creek. I've been trying to explain it, that it's sort of a resting place where the migratory birds?
Yeah, it's right on the big flyway from north to south. So they flock in there. I've seen geese there you wouldn't believe. But no guarantee this time that we're there. See, the weather's getting colder and they're going to hang around.
I know.
They go through sometimes in by the thousands. I saw one time I walked out the backyard. And snow geese are going by. Mm. They were low, very, very, very low, and they're way back of the house. They were flying single file. And I bet you the line of them was probably 3 football field lengths.
Really?
Yeah. So I got I watched this big chain going. It's up over the top of the trees, down, down, down. Never seen it since.
Huh.
Sometimes you can hear them coming. All honking away. Sounds exactly like that. You want to know?
They do. Okay, Uncle Locke, we just saw a sign, Dead Creek Wildlife Management. And the good news is I see some cars up ahead. I see.
There's a lot of times the geese get out in there. See?
Okay.
Right. There they go. See them?
Yep. All right, now
look at the cars here.
I know.
Well, that means a lot of geese. Look at them out there. See them?
Yep. Let's go up there. Oh, look, there's geese.
At Dead Creek, we met up with my cousins and Brian Pfeiffer, a member of the Vermont Audubon Society, who runs several bird tours.
We're seeing regularly Ross's goose. It's a small version of a snow goose. And people think that we're nuts, you know, because we come out here and we look for one Ross's goose. But it's also
name that thing again.
Ross's, R-O-S-S.
Ross's.
R-O-S-S apostrophe S.
Yeah, okay.
Ross's
goose. Huh?
Yeah. Small. They're out here.
Yeah, I want to see one now.
Yeah,
see,
so do I.
Yeah.
Hey, but look, I'm looking up there. I'm way up, much higher than the others we've seen. There's a V forming. Are they leaving?
Also, if you look right over the parking lot here, is a bird that's hovering. That's a red-tailed hawk hovering. But yes, those birds are leaving. You notice the V formation?
Yeah.
You see how one arm of the V is longer than the other?
Yeah.
They've actually figured out why that is.
Yeah.
The longer arm has more geese in it.
Oh, my gosh. Hundreds, thousands of them. Uncle Lock, look. Thousands.
Around.
Yeah.
Here they come.
That's why I look at him.
I will never forget the look on my uncle's face. He'd put on my cousin's cape because of the cold, and when the birds rose up, probably because of that hawk, so did he. It was as if the ground where the snow geese were had been covered with snow, and then someone scooped it all up and threw it in the air like confetti.
One great fall experience. And you had it. I mean, when they all flew over your heads, you know, I mean, that's just, I live for that every fall.
I bet I saw the snow geese one time going by down through Cornwall.
Yeah.
Looked out back, and it was nothing but a thin white line.
Yes.
As far as you could see, and tree height. As far south as you see.
Okay. We're getting frozen.
That's right.
What'd you think?
Think about what?
The geese.
Oh, it's pretty nice. Yeah. I've seen millions of them, you know.
I know you have. But I saw the look on your face when that group lifted up.
Oh, it's tremendous, isn't it?
Yeah.
With weather like this, they'll be taken off out of here. They'll be gone.
Yeah.
When they go, it's like turning the light off. They're gone.
When you want to get something to eat?
Do I want to get something to eat?
Yeah.
Not particularly. Why, you?
Yes, I do.
Trip 3 years ago now to see the snow geese in Vermont with my uncle Lachlan McLaughlin Field, who died around this time last year at 91. I think of him often, especially when I see a line of geese stretched across the sky.
A thin white line as far as you can see, and tree height. One long column. When they go, it's like click, turning the light off.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young from all of us. Happy Thanksgiving, and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.